Aloha and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we like to say each week, this conversation includes you. But just a reminder, this is a rebroadcast of today's Town Square, and so phone calls will not be taken at the number given. Consider this. According to the National Institutes of Health, $1.3 billion was spent on Alzheimer's disease in 2015, compared to $919 million for anxiety, bipolar disorders, depression, schizophrenia, and suicide combined. Alzheimer's affects 1 in 10 Americans over 65, or 5.5 million people. American adults 18 and up with any form of mental illness in a given year is 1 in 5, or 43.4 million. Today on Town Square, we'll look at what it will take to create parity in dollars and understanding between physical and mental illness. Joining me today, Dr. Bill Haining. He's professor of psychiatry at the Johnny Byrne School of Medicine at UH. He's also the director of the medical doctorate programs for the school and as director of the addiction psychiatry and addiction medicine department. Tricia Kajimura is also here. She's the executive director of Mental Health America of Hawaii. Its national organization is celebrating 75 years this year. And Mike Durant, the National Alliance on Mental Illness Hawaii board president, family support group facilitator, and member of the Hawaii State Council on Mental Health. And of course, you're here too. Again, our number is 941-3689. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Beth.
I'm sure you all heard yesterday that Hawaii's population of homeless people, as reported in the Point in Time count, dropped 9%. And I was curious about the number of homeless people with mental illness. And I spoke to Greg Payton, Partners in Care General Membership Executive Chair. He had this to say.
It remains the same, and it's one of those phenomena. It's about 30% of the total population of people that are homeless have a severe and persistent mental illness. This is different from any of us who get, like we get depressed or we get anxious at times, or we have those periods transitions in our life. These are people with a lifelong disability. It's a major mental illness. And so those are the people that you see on the streets that are confused or disoriented, obviously psychiatrically impaired. And it takes a long time to engage those folks. And it remains across the United States, not just here in Hawaii. It's about 30%, a little higher or lower in different areas, of the general population of homeless people have a serious and persistent lifelong mental illness.
The decreases then that we're seeing are those in homeless families or people who have been chronically homeless for other reasons, certainly homeless veterans. As you try to approach those who are mentally ill to be able to hopefully decrease that population in future, what do you think could happen or might happen that would make a difference in that population?
You know, I think one of the biggest things that's happened, and I'm really happy about this last legislative session, there was extra money that has been actually allocated for homeless outreach. And that's really the key. When you have someone who's on the street, a homeless person, a homeless adult who is mentally ill and is psychotic, they're not going to be able to track what you're saying or what you're talking about. But the frequency, we go out and visit people across the Hawaiian Islands. We go out and visit people several times, dozens of times, may take weeks to months before somebody will actually begin to trust us and say, well, come in, take a shower, have a meal, and then begin to talk with other people that are in recovery, that got off the streets, and they have a lot more credibility, be able to talk to peers, and then begin to see a psychiatrist and get off the streets. That can take months at a time. But I think the extra money that was put into the budget this year for homeless outreach is going to go a long way to helping solve the problem for this particular population of people that are homeless.
So given that pool of money that's now available, what does that translate into in terms of the number of people that you may be able to hire or additional outreach that you may be able to do?
Well, not just us, but also other providers that are out there that also work with this population of people. Depending on the area and what the need is, it could be anywhere from, could be like one person in an area like Kona or Hilo. It could mean a dozen people in a place like Honolulu. So it really kind of depends on the area, the need. The good thing about, we work together with our organization, our continuum of care. People may have heard that word before. Every city that receives HUD homeless funding has a continuum of care. In Hawaii, the continuum of care on Oahu is called Partners in Care, and the continuum of care on the neighbor islands is called Bridging the Gap. We mine the data, take a look at what the needs are, and try to fill in the areas that need to be met. So we'll be able to take the current point in time count and take a look at the areas across the state and figure out where that money should be allocated.
And how concerned are you about federal monies streaming into the state and then into nonprofits, including yours and other outreach organizations, when we seem to be in a very different political climate than we have been when this has been ongoing over many, many years?
Yes, it's not just a concern for us here in Hawaii and providers here. It's a concern, I'm sure, across the country. The people that we are working with that are homeless on the streets, and particularly the people with serious and persistent mental illness, the use of Medicaid dollars is critical. So organizations, health plans that have, for example, here locally, that have a MedQuest population, it's going to be critical for us to be able to tap into those dollars. Without that, the person who is, as I said before, is psychotic or confused, gravely disabled on the streets, they're the folks that need to have those professional services, psychiatry and medications and things like that. And so it's important that we are able to tap into that. So that's an advocacy issue that we will have to be very concerned about in the next couple of years.
That was Greg Payton. We talked to him yesterday. He is the executive chair for the Partners in Care membership. I want to reintroduce my panel here. We have Mike Durant, National Alliance on Mental Illness Hawaii Board President, Tricia Kajimura, the Executive Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii, and Dr. Bill Henning from the Johnny Burns School of Medicine. He's Professor of Psychiatry, among many other things. We're glad to have all of you here. You just heard what Greg Payton had to say exclusively about homeless population also coping with mental illness. But I'd like to go right around the table and have each of you just give us what your view is of mental illness in Hawaii from your perspectives in dealing with families, other populations, and get a sense of, you know, the wholeness of this issue that we're looking at now. And Dr. Haney, I'll start with you.
My view, of course, comes from the standpoint of being a designated provider of care and an educator of folks who would provide care. The concern that I have derives really from the inability of a lot of the folks who have these illnesses to take care of their own needs, in the same sense that we expect of people who have diabetes or who have other chronic or relapsing or recurring illnesses. It's always been troublesome to me, and I tend to get kind of on a soapbox with the medical students regarding addressing people who have schizophrenia or who have bipolar disorder as being schizophrenics or being bipolar in the sense that they are themselves the illness. That's troublesome. We do it to a certain extent with illnesses such as diabetes, but we don't go quite that far afield, and I think it creates an automatic prejudice in terms of limiting the breadth of our view of the human being who has this illness.
Prejudice and marginalization.
It's real hard, I think, for folks to be able to understand this or really to want to understand this. It's hard enough for me. We're talking about illness states that are addressed in terms of their behaviors or their presentations. It's not like there are blood tests for this. It's not like there are imaging studies for this. It's sometimes even difficult to convince the folks who would be involved in the care of people with these illnesses that they even have these illnesses. Because of the sometimes frustration, the common frustration, or the fearfulness of dealing with these illnesses for a lot of folks, there's a tendency to dismiss them as bad behavior, period, and not particularly something that you can do anything about.
Which we'll talk more about as we move into the hour. Tricia Kajimura from Mental Health America of Hawaii.
I think there's no doubt that people living with mental illness are really struggling. And of course, if you're homeless, that's all going to be magnified because you're not in a safe environment where you can cope with the daily stressors that your mental illness itself brings. And what we heard from Greg Payton from Partners in Care is really correct, that the resources required to bring people into recovery from that situation are huge. So if we're talking about reducing homelessness by treating the mentally ill from the street, we're talking about a lot more money.
And what about in the general population?
Right. But what I wanted to mention is prevention. If we are equipped as a community to talk about mental illness at an earlier age, to educate the general public as well as our elected leaders, teachers, children, every level, we can hopefully prevent some of the severe cases that we are now dealing with in the homeless population.
Thank you. Mike Durant.
Yes, thank you, Bethann. One of the interesting things is that Dr. Hanning talked about was trying to reach people on the street, and one of the problems is they often don't feel they have an illness at all, so they don't understand that they have an illness. And secondly, they're not going to seek treatment, and trying to get them off the street is very difficult. The support from family or friends is very important. If you do have family or friends, you can help them get off the street. And we have a support group that NAMI has many support groups. We have my wife and I facilitate one, and we often have people who come and have had their son or daughter out on the street and has had some success getting them off the street. Not always, but one of the interesting things is that what we find that even those that are not on the street, just suffering from the mental illness, is that they're refusing treatment. And the family's biggest frustration is trying to get them into some kind of treatment. Just get them to a doctor. They simply won't do it. And there are very few tools you can use to get them in. And meanwhile, they're struggling. Sometimes they're living at home, but it's very disruptive at home, and they just don't know what to do. So,
well, thank you all for your perspectives as we're going into this discussion. If you're just joining us now on Town Square, we're taking a look at mental illness in Hawaii. We know that there are thousands of people who are affected by it and families affected by it, perhaps even yours. If you'd like to join the conversation, 941-3689 is our number. And just a reminder, you're listening to a rebroadcast of Town Square, and calls will not be taken at the number given. Dr. Hanning, as you were saying, that you deal with students, medical students, and trying to get them to better understand some of these issues and some of the differences, and to be able to create parity in the way they look at those diseases, both mental and physical. Are they beginning to understand that they really can look at this in the same way?
I don't think there's ever been any reluctance on the part of medical students to try and learn this. They're little learning machines. They understand that to be their purpose, but the programming isn't all that simple. We're talking about essentially healthy human beings whose personal experience certainly of mental illness may be relatively limited. In any case, for any of these illnesses, it's hard to establish empathy when you have not yourself actually experienced it, and then when, in fact, the manifestations of the illness are sometimes frightening and certainly, as I say, can be frustrating. Most of the people that we encounter are shy people, and necessarily so. They're reluctant. I know that may sound funny to somebody who's encountered a person on the street who's creating a lot of noise and discontent and disruption, but there's a certain method in that, too, in terms of keeping away the things of which you are afraid. People with schizophrenia commonly will have paranoia. They will be terribly frightened of the environment, and the best way to deal with a hostile environment is offense as the best defense. People with major depression are going to be reluctant to socialize. They'll withdraw. They'll insulate. In fact, if you had to find a common denominator for, and there probably isn't just one, but a closest thing to a common denominator for all of these illness states, it would be a tendency to withdraw from or isolate from or not socialize while you're experiencing them. That makes it a little difficult to get inside of it.
Whether they're out there on the street or whether they're in your living room.
Right. So for the students, in large part, it is very much as it is with all the other illnesses, is to put them in proximity to the people who have the illnesses and bring them to do what they do best, which is to pay close attention to what the phenomena, what the expressions are, and to try and talk with folks who have illness. And the school is pretty good in that regard in terms of integrating the student into the community. But just one thing, though, more about the students for the general audience is to remind them that the doctors who come out of medical school aren't the ones that they're going to be seeing all that much. They still have to go through residencies. They have to go through supplemental trainings. The process of actually becoming a competent physician is going to be a minimum of 8 years after college. So this learning process is involved and protracted.
Which is to also say, though, there are greater opportunities even after they finish medical school for them to be continuing to do this. And as the stigma of mental illness is gradually wearing away, maybe there will be more opportunities for them to not only experience it, have some compassion about it, and understand it better.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the interesting things, though, that I've been noticing is that in doctor's appointments, sometimes a patient will be asked, have you been depressed lately in the last 2 weeks? How are you feeling? Which was a very different question than might have been asked in that way. I mean, specifically calling out depression, for example, even a few years ago. Not to give a great deal of, you know, hope that suddenly that's going to catch everything, but some of the doctors are reporting that they're catching 3, 4, 5 people that might not otherwise have sought treatment. How prevalent is it that doctors are asking that question, nurses are asking that question, that a patient will hear that question?
So we're constantly being encouraged to widen the pores in the screen. In other words, to ask those kinds of questions that you're posing, to try and elicit that information. And we're at war with certain forces that make it difficult to know what to do with that information or even necessarily to have enough time to collect it.
What are those forces?
Well, they're principally economic forces. So this is one of the few countries in the world that continues to regard provision of medical care as a mercantile industry. Okay, we're actually, there are demand and supply features involved and competition in the provision of pharmaceuticals or of actual care. It's hard for a physician who is in primary care seeing a patient for 8 to 10 minutes to conduct to compose a medical record and to actually have a conversation with somebody without just staring at an electronic screen while the patient is sitting off to one side without being in eye contact. To actually convince the patient that you care enough to hear what he or she is about to say about intimately their mood state, whether they're in fact having suicidal thoughts, whether they're hearing things that they have never heard before, is, I won't say difficult. It verges on the impossible because the patient is not a fool. They're recognizing that the physician can't actually adapt to what they're saying, and so they'll do the usual polite civil thing, which is
simply
to say, I'm fine. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Henning. If you want to join the conversation, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about mental illness today. We know that this affects millions of people across the United States, thousands in Hawaii, maybe some that you know, could be you, could be someone in your family. We know this is difficult to talk about, but what's the alternative if the stigma about mental illness is not going to wear away? Certainly not on its own. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Let's talk about it. Going now to Dave calling us from Kaneohe. Aloha, Dave. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. You know, I think the most profound thing about this whole, the mental health system, really, is just the way we disperse medical care in this country. I mean, we had a kind of a start with the Affordable Care Act, but now it looks like Trump and his friends are going to screw that all up. And so their only other way we can deal with it is put a lot of these people in jail without any kind of proper
And a lot of people have been saying that that's been the revolving door for many, certainly those who people encounter on the street. Dave, did you have a particular question or something else that our panel can answer for you?
You know, as much as you folks, I mean, you folks are the professionals. I mean, you're trying hard to do your darn job, but it was this dysfunctional system that, well, like you folks are talking about, the lack of resources right there. And really, what happens, these people can't work, so they can't make enough to provide housing and other necessities that you need. So, these folks are having a hard time coping with life as it is, and then they have no resources to speak of.
Which then becomes
the housing. Really, they really want to make some progress with this. Is really expand the housing first way to do this, to make sure many, many more get in housing, and then they can deal with this. I was thinking, and you know what? If you do this right, you can actually have people actually going to work, at least on a part-time basis. But it has to be a system that really, really cares for folks.
All right, Dave. I think that's the bottom line: is how do you care for folks across the spectrum, with both physical and certainly in this case mental illness, and see that doing maybe more on the front end is going to result in a lot less on the back end and less of a drain on the states and the community. Thanks very much for your call. Let's talk about that just a little bit. He's saying, look, our system is dysfunctional, and he was keying off of what you said, Dr. Haining, about that. And it sounded a little bit like, we're not going to get ourselves out of this. Right now we have so many questions about what may be happening with health care. Certainly the ACA is still the law of the land. And so long as that's so, then at least there has been a little bit more that's been covered for mental illness in recent years. But how concerned are all of you about what may happen if, in fact, we see that rolled back, given the fact that we are still in Hawaii, and if some of the protections under the ACA and the prepaid health care are merged in the way that we saw try to happen this last session, that we may feel a greater protection than, say, other people in other states. Tricia?
Well, certainly I think that in Hawaii we are very fortunate that we have the prepaid health care law, and I feel like we are in a better position than some other states to continue to provide the level of services we're providing now. However, as we've already talked about, that really hasn't been adequate, and we do need to keep working on it. I'm very concerned about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and with the administration's attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but that hasn't happened yet. So it's important not to, I think, really feed off of the fear of that, but to keep working, to keep advocating nationally and locally for parity and for the services we need. The caller mentioned Housing First, which has a lot of proponents here, including Partners in Care, and certainly something that we need to keep supporting and expanding.
Mike Grant?
Second that thing on our prepaid health care act, and it is going to insulate us to some extent. Then a lot of the people who are dealing with mental illness are often covered by Quest. I believe that's under Medicaid, and that should continue along. It's just the individual market that will ultimately be affected by this, which is pretty small but still very important. But going seconding on the Housing First program, that has proved to be very, very effective. One of the things, again, trying to get people with serious mental illness off the street is that they don't want treatment. They don't want this. If you really ask them what they want, if there is anything they want first, it's housing. And so the idea is to get them into housing first and then start to work with them on treatment. So it's very effective.
All right, we're going to move on. We've got callers coming in. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We had a shy caller who wanted to ask you, Dr. Haining, how much does substance abuse contribute to mental illness? And have you heard of the mental health first aid training for lay people?
So it's, aside from being the single biggest exacerbator of mental illness, it's also the most prevalent comorbidity. And sorry, big words that don't necessarily mean what I would want to tell. The fact is substance use disorders are themselves mental illness and constitute a severe impairment for the individual who's suffering from them. But that stirs up an awful lot of rancor among people who somehow or another believe that this is a matter of responsibility or irresponsibility.
Or choice.
Yeah, or choice. Mm-hmm. It's probably, with respect to mental health provision as first aid, I think an awful lot is solved when you actually inform people of what the illness consists and what the limitations are of, I'm not saying this well, how little is required actually to deal well with people with substance use disorders or with mental illness in general. If you make someone confident about being next to another person who has an obvious illness, then they can do much simply by listening and by assisting.
Which is kind of what I heard him talk about with his mental health, or saw him talk about mental health first aid training, mm-hmm. which was available for lay people to be able to do exactly what you've suggested.
It's not complex. It's recognizing what the limitations are for the person who has, say, schizophrenia are, and what it is they are and aren't capable of doing or responding to. You know, we don't have the best medications. That is, in the sense that they don't fix the illness. Certainly, if we limit ourselves to a discussion of schizophrenia, we've got much better medications than when I first started out in medicine around 1971. But that's only compared to what existed before. They still all have adverse side effects. There's still very few people with schizophrenia who want to take the medications because they have these unpleasant qualities to them, and you somehow or another have to convince them that there's a very little additional benefit conferred on them. It's a significant benefit. It can make all the difference between surviving and not.
All right. We're going to leave it there for a moment, unless there's one more point you want to make quickly, because we've got a full bank of callers who want to talk to all of you.
Only that most of the folks who have these illnesses are being right now funneled through one conduit, which is the doorway to Queens Medical Center and sometimes to Castle Medical Center. Later on in the show, we may have a chance to talk about what the state's responsibility has been in all of this.
All right, and we will. First, though, we're going to go take some of our callers, going to Wendy calling us from Molokai. Aloha, Wendy. Welcome to Town Square.
Oh, hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two sons that have, they both have schizophrenia. One has schizoaffective disorder, and they're twins, identical twins. And, you know, so first one developed the illness and then the other one. But I was very fortunate because I had a doctor that he said, I had the situation where I was totally frustrated, not knowing how to deal with a person with my son with mental illness living in my home, and he was so helpful because he said to me, if he doesn't want to get treatment, tell him he has to move out of your house and give him a month's notice. And I did that, and he moved out within 3 days because he didn't want to, you know, be part of any treatment though. And then he ended up and he found himself an apartment. But within a month, things were so bad that they were able to commit him to the hospital. So luckily he got treatment much, much, much quicker than if I had have, you know, allowed him to stay with me and care for him.
Wendy, thank you so much for being so brave and calling us. And I think many hearts go out to you with not just one son, but with twins who have schizophrenia. How are they? How's your other son doing now?
Well, they're both in care because they both require, my son Paul lives in a group home and my son Mark is in a family care home. They can't, they're not living, they can't really live independently. So their illness is quite, fairly severe.
Well, Wendy, we wish you and your family truly all the best that can happen from this point forward. And thank you so much for calling us to share your story.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Very difficult situation, but she's also making a point that her doctor was giving her sort of the tough love aspect. You know, tell him he's got to move out, put him in a situation where maybe things are going to worsen to the point where there will be help. But for a lot of people, they say that's a real gamble given our system.
part of the problem is conceptual in terms of legislative, in terms of the current state of legislation for management of people with severe mental illness. I think the other two participants can probably speak better to this than I, but it is currently difficult to get somebody the care that they need against their will. And that should probably irritate some listeners right now, because the concept of being of doing anything against someone's will is anathema in this country. But these are illnesses that dissolve the ability to see objectively or to recognize that one has an impairment. Some of the better laws in the state were written actually as territorial laws back in 1915 and involved the provision of humane care for people with, at that time, untreatable illnesses. And it led to the formation of the territorial hospital, Kaneohe, of course, which as recently as the mid-1950s had a population that was well over 1,000. And that was in a territory then that was only about 400,000 people. But they took kind, good care of people in those settings, and they recognized that to let them go out on the streets was a misguided interpretation of the word freedom or autonomy. We still have a lot of that situation obtaining now.
You bring up this real battle over whether someone should be committed or not. There's a book that just came out last summer, Dr. Dinah Miller and Dr. Annette Hansen, called Committed, and they call it The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care, and detail exactly that kind of angst between what do you do when you think that this should be happening or you need some help, and trying to see that the needs of the individual and the rights of the individual are protected. It's a really thorny issue, but a very good book. Our number is 941-3689 if you'd like to join the conversation today. We're talking about mental health in Hawaii, 877-941-3689 if you call us from the neighbor islands or if you're listening to the live stream. Going now to Tom, calling us from Kamuela. Aloha, Tom. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, aloha. Yes, I'm a retired police officer from Waimea, and back in the 90s up through the 2000s, and you know, it doesn't seem that there are efforts to improve the system and improve the infrastructure to handle this sort of problem in society. But when you see the monies that are being thrown at, for example, transportation, you know, you wish you shoulda, coulda, woulda. Why couldn't we have taken $100 million of that money and put it towards the not to make it a Band-Aid, but to help with this situation as far as housing and so forth, where we see on the Big Island, where we even have more veterans that are coming out with PTSD and homeless veterans. And, you know, to be able to maybe partner with the Department of Veterans Affairs, which is actually the largest healthcare system in the world, you know, it has to start somewhere. And, you know, the first responders daily deal with this. And I would get calls every day on a person that may have a difficulty with their behavior, and we find out that it's someone who's being treated for, you know, schizophrenia, or it could have been brought on by drug abuse. And we would see that also with a person who was addicted to crystal methamphetamine, how it would affect them. And you can only be empathetic with these people if they don't break the law. There is not much that you can do unless they can, like the earlier caller was saying, where they voluntarily committed themselves into a program. You're basically have your hands tied.
Tom, I thank you so much for calling. Hearing from a retired police officer, and he's talking about a situation, though he experienced that when he was still active, that many officers still experience today. And the question really isn't, and obviously you may or may not be able to speak to this panel, but with the police and training and sensitivity and understanding some about mental illness, certainly not enough, has it gotten any better with what happens when a police officer is called, obviously, depending upon the police officer. But in general, Mike?
Well, we do have a program on Oahu. Actually, every island has a program of how they handle people with serious mental illness, and each one is a little different. But on Oahu, we have a police psychologist on call 24 hours a day, and we always advise our NAMI members and people who are looking for support to if they call the police, to tell them that this person has a serious mental illness, and then normally they'll contact the police psychologist. So they do a good job when they work with the police psychologist. One of the interesting things is that's usually the way somebody gets into treatment, and if they've been disruptive enough, the police can take them straight to the hospital, either Coachella or Castle. My son has passed away. He had schizophrenia. He was hospitalized 7 or 8 times, and I think only once he went by himself. The other times he always went with the police. And so, just as that last caller says, they are the front lines. And of course, the better job we can do helping our people with serious mental illness is that it relieves the police. They know they're spending almost half of their time dealing with these people.
But you're really saying, though, is, if I can just pull some of that out, is that families have to be intimately involved with this, and you have to be willing to pick up the phone and say, by the way, this person is mentally ill. This is what this person is being treated for, and to give them some context. A lot of families, you know, especially with this, still feel that they're reticent to do that. And what I've been hearing all of you say for quite some time is that, look, you got to get over that, because not only does the health and well-being of your loved one depend upon it, the health and well-being of so many other people who have mental illness and their families also depends on your being willing to open your mouth and talk to somebody about it. I'm watching you nod, Tricia.
Yeah, at Mental Health America of Hawaii, we have a helpline for people dealing with mental health issues or family members looking for help. We also get calls from professionals. And to calling 911, unfortunately, is a common piece of advice that we do give to family members who often have someone with untreated mental illness living with them. That's very disruptive, sometimes causing severe problems for their families. And you do need to – we give them the same advice that Mike just
gave us. Well, if they're being violent,
us,
what other
– Right.
What other you know, option do you have except to call and say, I need some help? If somebody's throwing stuff at you, we're throwing you.
And I think it's important for family members to know that part of getting help for their loved one is getting help for themselves, learning how to control their own emotions and dealing with this very disruptive family problem. And there is no shame in seeking therapy and counseling for themselves when they're trying to help a family member with addiction and or other mental illnesses.
And quite possibly help them to deal with that person in situations that will continue to arise a little bit better when they're realizing that they can't rationalize with this person the same way that you and I might sit down and have a conversation and talk over an issue, in which anger is a great part, or addiction, or anything else that we've been talking about so far. Our number is 941-3689 if you would like to talk with us, or 877-941-3689 is today on Town Square. We're looking at mental illness in Hawaii. Lots of people have stories. Lots of people have had experience with this. How about you? How do you look at how mental illness is handled in Hawaii? What do you wish could happen? And how do you see that that might be so? Going now to, I think this is Tui. I'm sorry, Tui calling us from Kau.
Yes, I am. Thank you
for
taking my call.
I couldn't tell whether that was an I or an L on my machine here. Thank you.
It's
an I. Hi, Tui.
Hi. I won't take a lot of your time, but I guess what I'd like to say mostly is thank you to NPR. I love you guys and the service that you provide. This is amazing. And I got very emotional listening to your show this morning because I'm the mother of a 36-year-old bipolar boy, man now. And so I've been dealing with this, and he has for 20 years. It was a very different story 20 years ago. And, you know, the problems are legion. The conversations are, you know, could go on and on. I just wanted to say that there are no solutions to this problem until people, like the lovely people you have on your panel, get their heads, their smart heads together and their hearts and talk about this and educate the communities and the people. So this is really good for me to hear. It just warms my heart because that's where it starts.
Well, Tui, thank you. Thank you so much for, A, your patience in being able to get into the queue, and also for your lovely words. We really appreciate it. And Mike Durant would like to answer you.
Yeah, I would like to say that NAMI has support groups and educational classes called family to family, and we have affiliates on all the neighbor islands, the major neighbor islands. And if you just go to NAMIHawaii.org, you can look up and see the classes availability and the support groups. We have about 7 or 8 support groups on Oahu and at least one on each neighbor island. And find that the support group is really the first place you want to go, because you'll find out more about it and then maybe get into going to an education class.
And find a little bit of love and support there, too, just right. Person to person. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go and take a – did you want to add something to that, Dr. Haney?
I did, because I like the way that you're trying to keep bringing this around to what we – about the perceptual shift that's required in order to manage this at least as well as we're managing other obviously physical illnesses. There are maybe 36 acute care beds at Queens for psychiatric illness. There are about 600 beds all told over in that magnificent hospital, and it really is. But that's how many we have to play with in terms of management of an endless procession of folks who are going in and out of the emergency room each night. And they'll come in, and if we get it down right, then they're turned around in a couple or 3 days, but they will then return back through the emergency room.
Which is costly, particularly if many of these people do not have insurance.
It's
and
costly.
We have to put them in under MedQuest, and that means we're paying for that too.
And it's dangerous to them. They're going back out and coming back in, and it's essentially an endless series of little relapses. The largest mental health hospital in Hawaii is actually not a hospital per se. It is OCCC. And OCCC, I'm really proud of certain people in our department who have been pivotal in setting up, including OCCC staff itself, in allowing the department to come in as the psychiatrists of record for the patients there. It's a very, very large mental health unit there. We have our own faculty down there as well as our residents as part of a training program in order to provide services. But understand that that's actually the only long-term treatment facility outside of Hawaii State Hospital.
Okay, but this is bringing up the question that we talked about a little bit earlier and said that we come back to, and let's come back to it now. What's the responsibility of the state? I mean, we have the state hospital that now has a new campus for which there is a final impact statement. We know that they also contract out about 40 beds or so to Kahimohala. Things may change in future with that, but looking at those incredibly acute cases, that's not necessarily the population of folks that you are talking about. But in general, how do you see the state better being able to meet the needs of the people that you all see in some fashion?
One is to change the status. Right now, the place you're talking about will still be a forensic hospital. It'll be necessary to criminalize the individual with the illness in order to get them the necessary care. This is not all that different from treating diabetes. It's just conceptually different in terms of how we'll allocate the resources. If somebody's got advanced diabetes and all of the unfortunate consequences of that in terms of cardiac disease or in terms of infrequent infections, we put a net around those folks. We bring in social workers and dietitians, and we insist on regular visits and 5 times a day finger prick tests as well as A1Cs. I'm building a case for saying that we actually manage diabetes reasonably well here, and the only thing that distinguishes our ability to manage diabetes from schizophrenia is that they have houses. They generally end up, with rare exceptions, in a place where the team can get to or from which they can travel fairly readily for medical care. If you provide that sort of thing, as IHS attempts to, as many homes attempt to, in terms of a fixed place for intervention, then you begin to see positive results. But that requires the opportunity to do civil commitment without obstruction.
Some are concerned that if someone is committed or is then labeled as being mentally ill, that that's going to be a label for life, and that may prevent certain other things that may happen later on, being able to get a job perhaps or other things. I mean, how don't we have to more finely distinguish what that looks like at a much more granular level? I know you'd say, let's get to the bigger part first, and then we'll work down.
We do, but at the risk of getting in trouble here, I think our sensitivity to, I think our sensitivity about the labels is getting in the way of provision of adequate care.
All right, we're going to leave it there for a moment. Take a few more callers. Lots of people want to talk to you. Ron calling us from Kailua Kona. Thank you for your patience, and welcome to Town Square.
Hi. My son was bipolar, and I want to make a comment on the situation with substance abuse. He would just do he didn't take meth that I know of, but he did the next best thing. He'd sit down and take 96 Sudafeds at a time, and I'd have to rush him to the hospital. And he had, alcohol was his main support system. And this is there too. Many of them, they don't like the drugs. They don't like the side effects. They don't like the feelings. They just want to be normal. And also that we were NAMI members. We aren't any longer, but we were NAMI members. I worked the monthly assistance to the people who were coming in that had friends and family that were had that problem. My wife taught the family to family program when it was due. That was a 12-week program, and we need to see that there is a definite connection between the self-medication and the need to get other medications for them.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but I think you're bringing up the point that being vigilant about family members and understanding that what you may be viewing is something and that sometimes people, laugh it off isn't something that needs to be laughed off, and that it's okay to be a little bit more vigilant about your family members and to see that there may be a deeper issue going on. And good for you for seeking support and also for being willing to help others. That's, I think, part of what our panel has been advocating during this conversation. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. We're going now to Michelle calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Michelle. Welcome to Town Square.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't even know where to start. I'm the daughter of a Hawaiian man that spent much of his life on the mainland with schizophrenia, and so many obstacles along the way that we had to encounter. But me as the daughter, not finding out in my early 20s that he had mental illness, and being asked if I could be his guardian, his legal guardian, which I was afraid to do because I didn't think Hawaii had the facilities to take care of the man that I called dad.
That must have been quite a shock for you. Finding out as you did, but then suddenly finding yourself, not only do you have to figure this out for yourself and what it means for your own life, but also now being asked to care for someone. So you've been doing this now for a while?
Actually, he passed away a few years ago. He was on the streets of Hollywood as a homeless man for many, many years, and I was just told by family members as a kid growing up that he had a drug problem, and to not deal with him, that he was a drug addict, and that's what they thought. And it wasn't until I made contact with him when I was about 18 that I found, after a few awkward conversations on the phone, that he definitely was suffering from mental illness, and he had been medically discharged. And I spent his whole life trying to find out why he was medically discharged. Wasn't until after he died that I got paperwork that said he was discharged because of schizophrenia. Well, and they still, in his medical military files, will not say what caused it, but he was discharged for that at the time.
Michelle, good on you for being willing to pursue it and find out just to give yourself some peace. And also for being willing to not just listen when someone says, he's just an addict and a throwaway person, particularly as you found out he's your dad, but to be instructive to other people, too, not to throw away some of their relatives or maybe listen to other relatives who, for their own reasons, may be saying what they did, and certainly to you. Thanks so much. Thanks very much for the call. We also had a shy caller phone who says, wants some information about programs to help patients to develop creative skills. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by creative skills. Maybe you can call us back and give us a little bit more information. We'll talk about that. You want to cut?
Well, he might be referring to what consumers and other people with a mental illness, that's the name they like to be called. And there is an organization, United Self-Help, who has classes and support groups for consumers. It's a very good organization.
Okay, good. Thank you. Hope that answers your question at least a bit. Going to go now to Dan, a retired psychiatric nurse who worked in Oregon. Aloha, Dan. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello.
Hi there.
I wanted to mention that having worked in Oregon for many years, and 40 years total in the inpatient psychiatric hospitals as a registered nurse, one thing that I found to be troubling moving to Hawaii was that we were only allowed a 72-hour period of time for a physician's hold in order to be able to try and begin some sort of treatment. And often that means trying to gain the trust of the patient so they'll begin to accept some sort of treatment. In Hawaii, you get 72 hours, and that's just not enough. They walk out the door before they begin to engage. Whereas in Oregon, you had a full week, and oftentimes that was enough time to actually begin to establish some sort of a dialogue. What's more, patients who were committed, once they were ready to leave the hospital, would sign contracts saying that they would agree to take their medicines, not drink alcohol, a number of things that we knew would create problems for them if they were to engage in those activities once they left the hospital.
All right, Dan, in the interest of time, I'm going to interrupt you because I think you've made some good points already that our panel would like to talk about and answer, or at least discuss a little bit more. Thank you very much for the call. Part of what he's bringing up is this idea of time, and clearly time that's covered by insurance, recoverable costs, all of that, and the numbers of people who are cycling in and out. He mentioned the week in Oregon versus the 72 hours here. What do you do in 3 days versus what you can do in a week? Some would say, a week sounds like not very much time either, but at least it's double than what it is now. Clearly, Barry, as I'm watching you, Dr. Haining, you're smiling over this.
Well, I'm
and
smiling
I'm
because,
ruefully, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, rueful is a good, that's a nice adjective. So Dan's point's well taken, but it's even worse. It's actually only 48 hours here. But I am quick to add, that's actually not the problem for us so much. The 48 hours is intended to ascertain the level of further need, and then a petition is filed with the court in order to get a longer standing, a longer commitment. So you go from what's called an MH4 or a voluntary admission form of an MH5, and it progresses to an MH6 if, in fact, your intention is to keep somebody past that period of time. So there are steps one takes that preserve the civil rights and preserve to what extent is possible the autonomy of the patient. It obliges this sort of thing to take place in a court-style hearing that occurs on the campus of the hospital itself. Now, that's not to say that misunderstandings or misrepresentations don't occur, but it's just about as open a process as you can get and still respect the dignity of the patient. The problem has to do with the actual, well, frankly, with the financial support for this. It's all well and good to say somebody needs to stay in the hospital because that particular pregnant woman has schizophrenia and the medications may risk the child, so they need to be kept for a long period of time. And
but you're talking about insurance and who's going to foot the bill.
Somebody's got to be paying for that, and there has to actually be an available bed to use for that. As I said, we're facing acuity. You go ahead.
All right, forgive me, but we have a couple more callers who want to get in on this conversation. Lucy is calling us from Honolulu. She says she's a retired RN at the state hospital and has seen many great recoveries. That's a hopeful sign. Lucy, just want to make sure that you have turned down your radio so that we don't have any feedback and we can actually hear you. Aloha, Lucy.
Hi, I'm Lucy, and I am from Honolulu, and I have been a psychiatric RN and worked at the state hospital for about 7 years. But here's my question. I'm very, very interested in any types of substance abuse disorders, particularly alcoholism. And the modality treatment that just, I cannot believe how well it works. Not for everybody, but it's a free service, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why a lot of different organizations, nonprofits, who mean very well, but they don't realize what a great resource this is.
Okay, Lucy, I really appreciate that, but because we're running short of time, was there something else specific you wanted to ask of the panel? And I'm sure AA appreciates the plug and lots of people who have done so well with that. But is there something else that you wanted to mention quickly?
Yeah, the other thing is, why aren't psychiatric nurses like myself? I'm retired. Why aren't we employed? I'm actually a writer, and I write a lot about these things. Why aren't we encouraged or somehow tapped for the knowledge we have about these problems?
That's another question entirely, but very, very briefly, Dr. Haney, I mean, she's saying, look, we got knowledge, we could help. Is there a place for her to go? Certainly there are other organizations, and I think all of you would say, go check out Mental Health America of Hawaii, NAMI, and see where you might be able to volunteer your services. Let's go now to Garrett calling us from the Big Island. Garrett, aloha. Garrett. Welcome to Town Square, and I'm going to ask you in the interest of time to please be brief.
Okay. I basically want to say I agree with a lot of the callers that the problems that we're having here in Hawaii and in the United States is the substance abuse problems with prescription and illegal drugs. If you were to look at a lot of these patients that have mental illness, they were either past drug users or are currently drug users.
And forgive me for interrupting you, but I know that we talked a little earlier in the program about comorbidity, Dr. Haining, and that, you know, these things do not happen in isolation, and in part why we've been talking about when you see something on this end could be drug abuse, substance abuse, that there could be something else going on too, and being willing to look a little deeper into the situation.
It's difficult to distinguish the chicken from the egg and that kind of thing, simply because the drugs themselves can, of course, create a type of mental illness that's very refractory to treatment. And people who have serious mental illnesses will resort to what gets called self-medication.
But if I may interrupt for 1 second, I mean, I think the point that you're making, too, and have made, is that just because you're going to take a look at treating drug abuse or substance abuse, it's not necessarily going to take care of the issues with mental illness, and we can't conflate
Correct.
Those two.
Correct. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all so much for calling. We have just a couple minutes left before we have to say goodbye for the hour, and it's gone by very quickly, as these discussions often do. As you look at where we are right now and so many of the uncertain things, what is it, aside from going to a support group, being willing to look into a situation more differently, if we were to say we want to create a sea change in attitudes about mental illness, what advice do you have for those listening? You got about 10 seconds.
Let's
each.
Talk about it. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Ask questions. Ask your loved ones how they're doing. Talk about your own issues. Don't be afraid.
Open your mouth. Mike Duran.
Second that, I know when our son was first diagnosed, the doctor said, don't tell anybody because you don't want to stigmatize him for the rest of his life. And, of course, that's not something you want to do. Today, I don't think a doctor would give the same advice. Yes, you need to be open with it.
And Dr. Haney, I'll let you back clean up.
I'd like to remind folks that they do have legislators who are in their employ, and who, in fact, are in turn employing an entire faculty of psychiatrists who could be of use to them in giving good advice and constructing new law.
Dr. Bill Haney, Trisha Kajimura, and Mike Durant, thank you so much for joining me today for Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow right back here for The Conversation.